listening to the AHDB podcast, farming news and stories from across the UK.
Hello, my name's Neris Wright and I'm the Knowledge Exchange Manager for AHDB Beef and Lamb. And today's podcast, I'm being joined by Leslie Stubbings, Independent Sheep Consultant, and Gareth Owen, who farms at Hill Farm in Leicestershire. The focus of today's podcast is best practice worm control in ewes leading up to lambing. Thank you very much for joining us today, Leslie and Gareth. Leslie, if I just start off with you to talk a little bit behind the theory and science behind worming with a particular focus on pre-lambing. It's something that we tend to do and it's quite commonly done. So if you just talk a little bit about why it is that we have gone through worming pre-lambing.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, historically, the story has always been that we're looking at ewes as they get into the late period of pregnancy, then their immune system starts to relax a little bit. Now, normally with a ewe, when an immune system is working properly, she controls the worms in her gut very well and she only lets a few of them live in there, and that just, they have a nice little relationship and there's no problem. Very few eggs are put out onto the pasture from a ewe. But in late pregnancy, that changes a bit. When she gets under pressure, her immune system wanes a bit and those worms then start to produce more eggs. So really, I think one of the misconceptions is that people think that they're treating the ewes for the ewes' sake. And actually, that's couldn't be further from the truth. What we've really got into doing this for is to try and reduce the contamination that's going out onto pasture for lambs to pick up later in the season.
So how close to lambing do we start seeing that sort of periparturient rise in ewes, or is that multifactorial?
Oh, it's multifactorial. I mean, there are so many factors. Generally speaking, we'd probably expect to start picking it up maybe 2 or 3 weeks before, but it does depend on how well fed they are.
Okay.
And as we'll hear, the ewes here on the TMR, we see virtually no periparturient rise. How old they are, how good their immune system is, what their body condition score is, and so on. So, but generally, maybe 2 or 3 weeks we would expect to, if we're going to see a rise, we would see it then.
And how long does that tend to last for post-lambing?
Probably something up to around 5 or 6 weeks, but again, it depends. And to be honest, we have not got a lot of data to support this, because it's actually quite a difficult thing to monitor carefully on a commercial farm situation, because, you know, ewes get mixed up at lambing, so it's difficult to follow the same ewe through after lambing. So we have got very little data, and that's one of the things that we're trying to put right now.
So when you talk about it's reducing the contamination onto ground, then if ewes are housed, for example, does that change the need for worming them or not?
Not really, no. I mean, I think what we're trying to do is to remove that contamination from the ewes. And it's a bit of a moot point, really, because if we treat the ewes and then put them back out onto contaminated pasture, or the ewes are out on contaminated pasture, as soon as they're wormed, they're going to pick more worms up. So it is something where we would like to get to the bottom of just how few ewes can we treat and how many can we leave without there being a downside.
And so the way to identify what the need for worming or not, would it be the same as lambs, do a fecal egg count?
Yeah, it would, actually. And that's exactly what we're doing in this work that we're just starting now with a group of farmers in Wales, where we're monitoring on a weekly basis fecal egg counts within a decent sized mob of ewes, both pre and post lambing. And all of those farms, they would normally only treat a very small proportion of their ewes, but this time we're going to look and see if we need to treat, and if we do, when.
Yeah.
And to try and build that information up.
So how about what wormer to use at this time of year pre-lambing? I know some would use a long-acting wormer. Is that necessary for a short period of time?
And there's pluses and minuses. So if people do use a long-acting, a persistent wormer, what they've got to realise, I think, is that obviously one of the reasons why we're trying to cut down this amount of number of ewes being treated is we want to take some of the pressure off the development of resistance. So if people are going to use a persistent wormer, then that will reduce the contamination coming from the ewes. That's the general wisdom, but it is for a longer period of time. So it's really important that they don't treat all of the ewes. They really must leave at least 1 in 10 untreated. And that the other side of that it's really important that they take advantage of it and they then don't worm their lambs more than necessary. So they've really got to follow it up with doing some fecal egg counting so that they're not overworming their lambs and they're not going too far, too much pressure in terms of resistance.
Okay, so you mentioned leaving 1 in 10 as a minimum unwormed, if that's the protocol you're taking. How would you pick which ewes you do treat and don't treat?
Yeah, that's a really important point, that, Neris, because people have been talking for a while about, oh, well, just leave the singles and do all your triplets and your twins. But the problem with that is, of course, that the singles tend to then get grazed all together in a mob, don't they, after lambing, and all the twins and triplets are in other mobs. And what we really need is at least 1 in 10 in each of the grazing mobs. So I would say with the work that we've done, you know, we ought to be going on body condition. So singles, I would just worm anything that's lean, and equally with twins, if you're going to choose any to leave, make sure they're the fittest ones. And even with triplets, you know, if the triplets are fed really well and they're in good condition, we tend not to see a massive increase over and above the others in terms of egg output around lambing. It does come back to nutrition and body condition.
Thank you for joining us, Gareth. If you could just talk us through what your pre-lambing diet would be in your hives ewes.
Yes, we house all our ewes about 10 weeks prior to lambing now, and they're all fed on a forage-based TMR. Initially coming in with what we call a base diet of hay, plus regular maize, moving on to hay plus silage, and ending up on silage pre-lambing. And what's become apparent to us with getting that nutrition right in the run-up to lambing, the requirement to worm the ewes at lambing has been greatly diminished, coupled with getting the nutrition right and the use of FetPak Gen 2 that we've got, it's supported that on the whole there really isn't a need to worm or use pre-lambing. So historically we used to worm everything at lambing. That was just a routine that we had historically done, and with the evidence that we've collected over the last 5 years, we're now confident not to worm maybe 90% of the ewes. 10%, those that are lean, are triplet carrying ewes, we would worm. But that's an individual selection at time of turnout.
And so you made reference to the fecal egg counts that you're able to do on the farm here. How often or how soon before lambing would you start looking at those egg counts to sort of see and double check they don't need worming?
I mean, it's a few years ago now, but I think the first year we did it, we selected several groups within the shed, probably some single ewes, twin ewes, some lean twin ewes and triplets, and went back to that same group of sheep on a weekly basis. That then gave us the initial confidence and could see what was happening on all of them, including the thinner twins and the triplets. We didn't see a rise at all. So the last few years, we've probably done a couple of tests in the run-up to lambing just to confirm that.
And so you say sort of maybe start 3-4 weeks before lambing?
I guess we'd probably do a test at housing, so 10 weeks before, and then yeah, maybe 1 3-4 weeks in, and then 1 just prior to lambing. I mean, the beauty of the FetPak, having done that more detailed regular test in year 1, the FetPak's just giving you that confidence that, you know, your decision making is right, and I suppose ultimately picking up anything that, you know, is unforeseen.
And I think it's repeating it as well, because 1 fecal egg count in 1 time period in a year doesn't really tell you anything about what's happened and what's going to happen. So I think it's that consistency as well, and going back to them rather than just doing 1 egg count 3 weeks beforehand and going, oh, it's very low, let's leave them now. You have gone back to them and looked at that rise as they approach lambing to give you that confidence.
Yeah, and it's that confidence then that you need to not go and do it, which we've now got.
So just to consider other parasites then, Leslie, at this time of year that we need to just be aware of. That's been a very wet winter. There are alerts out for liver fluke. So is it worth us having a bit of a chat about how we would treat liver fluke this coming lambing time?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about liver fluke is that there are places where it is quite a high challenge this time and other places where it isn't. So it's very patchy. So thinking back to what happens with liver fluke in its life cycle, the really important time is mid-late summer, when if it's really wet then you get transmission. And actually the fact that it's been a really wet winter, the trouble if it was going to be set up last summer. So the mild temperatures have meant the liver fluke have kept going all winter. So if you've got a problem, it's still there. So what we've been trying to say to people this year is it's really important to do your monitoring. So with a lot of my clients now, if they sometimes have fluke and sometimes don't, we're taking fecal samples now and seeing whether or not fluke is actually there as to whether or not we need to treat. Because it's really easy, isn't it, to get fluke and worms mixed up and just think, oh, well, you know, I'll just treat for both. And clearly that's what we're trying to avoid people to doing.
So you treat the ewes for worms with a worming product, and you treat ewes for fluke with a flucicide, and not try and combine the two unless you know that two is needed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Combination products, it's actually relatively rare when you need to do both of those two things together. There's the odd occasion, but generally speaking, about now is a time where a lot of my flocks are doing some testing or deciding whether or not we're going to treat, and you've got your choice as to what you're actually going to treat with. But I think the other point to make about liver fluke now is that now's a really good time. If somebody thinks they might have triclobendazole resistance, now's the time to do it.
To test for it.
Because earlier on, people think that they've tested and it might have worked. But of course, people are using triclobendazole at the time when we haven't got adult fluke and there's no eggs to be found. So it's really quite difficult to establish it's definitely resistance or not until you get into the early part of the year.
And the best way to check that would be, what, a faecal egg count before and then X days after?
Pre and post.
Yeah.
You can do it with copper antigen tests now. And on the Scots Cows websites, there's instructions as to how to do that. But it's definitely a faecal test.
And so, Gareth, how about liver fluke on this farm? Is that something that you see on a regular basis?
On the whole, we don't have great problems with liver fluke. But what we've done with the ewes, again, is post-housing, we test them. And that test is either going to come back positive or negative. The last few years, it's come back negative and the ewes don't get treated. And when it does come back positive, then we would go and treat them. And that's done shortly after housing.
So you'd react to what the sheep are telling you it's happening. It's not something that's done routinely, which is best practice. So that's
absolutely
great. Okay, Leslie, so just come back to you on the point that Gareth has just made then about not seeing large periparturient rises in even thin ewes. Could you explain why you think that's happening here?
Yeah, I think here the difference is that with the TMR feeding, that the level of energy and protein that's going into these ewes right up to lambing, and because it, the diet, they can keep eating the same amount virtually up to the point of lambing, it masks the effect of body condition. So these thinner ewes, they've got lots of protein, way over the recommended level, for example, then that's probably why I'm not seeing it here. Whereas with a more conventional feeding system, we would expect to see that because it's not providing with standard plus in terms of energy and protein.
Okay, and it's both the energy and the protein that are important.
It is.
In this factor.
It is, because when a ewe gets into late pregnancy, what's happening effectively is why her immune system starts to sort of wane is that she's apportioning her nutrition that she's getting between the lambs, her udder, and her immune system. And the immune system starts to take a bit of a back seat. It gets the first limitation on the nutrition. So whether being fed on the TMR, nothing needs to give. I think basically that's what's happening.
Okay, so some of the worming products will also do external parasites as well, such as sheep scab. Is it worth us having a little bit of a discussion about how we can effectively treat and control sheep scab without inadvertently worming our ewes?
Yeah, that's another really important point, actually, because the injectables, obviously the injectable wormers, the group threes, they are also products which will treat sheep scab, and some of them obviously prevent sheep scab as well, the long-acting ones. So it's really important that when people are using those products, they realise that they're inadvertently worming their sheep. So if you've used one of those for one reason, don't use it for the other, certainly not within the same 12-month period, because the pressure you're putting on resistance, both on the sheep scab mites, on the worms, is quite significant. So we've got to be really careful with that. And I think the other thing is as well that a lot of people are using those products thinking that they've got sheep scab, and actually it's lice. And of course they don't treat lice, and then we end up spending a lot of money and using them unnecessarily. So they've really got to get a diagnosis.
And so we now have a really good blood test that has been developed by the Morden that can help diagnose sheep scab. So we've still got the skin scrape option that you do through your vet, but there's also the blood test. So that's something that's worth farmers knowing. If they're not sure, that is something else that they can look at as a tool.
It is.
It's
a very, very useful tool, that. So, you take a sample and it'll tell you whether or not they've had exposure to sheep scab. And you don't have to wait then until you've got out and out clinical signs and it's blown up all over the flock, which is, I think, one of the major advantages of it.
But then you're treating for scab or treating for lice and doing it targeted.
Definitely.
Okay. For those listening, there's a few manuals, further information for you. So you could go onto the Scops, www.scops.org.uk. On there are a number of guidelines. One is on using persistent wormers. One is on how to take a faecal egg count, as much as all the other information. At AHDB, we have our Worm Control for Better Returns manual. We also have a parasite control guide, and that really has all of the product information. I can never remember what product is in what group and what parasite it does. So that's a really good guide for those listening. And so just thank you very much, both of you, for your time today.
Thank you.
You're listening to the AHDB podcast, farming news and stories from across the UK.